Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we conclude our special two-part series marking the third anniversary of 9/11. We're focusing on a collection of essays originally published in the Journal of American History and then republished in 2003 by Temple University Press under the title History and September 11th. The essays help us to make sense of the background and the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. And that's what we hope to accomplish in these two programs. We'll not be hearing from Dan Roberts this week. Instead, we're making 9/11 our moment in time. But we will offer, as usual, our History in the News segment. For our site of the week, Fiona Beatty will be talking about an exhibit that contains recollections of and artifacts from 9/11. For our History in the News, we report on some recent developments related to what goes into and how we protect such archives. First, on the collection side, the Library of Congress has announced its latest group of 50 sound recordings it will digitally preserve for posterity. On the list are an 1888 recitation of the Lord's Prayer by Emile Berliner, inventor of the gramophone, which played a flat disc record instead of the wax cylinders that held the first sound recordings, the original cast recording of Oklahoma, and the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. These and other recordings are available at the Library of Congress's website, loc.gov. In another news report, the editors of the magazine History Today have done a survey of the major news film archives and published a list of the most popular or most commonly sought news clips from the 20th century. Topping this list is the 1969 moon landing featuring Neil Armstrong. Next in line is footage of the assassination of John F. Kennedy 6 years later. The oldest film on the list dates to 1913, when suffragette Emily Davison was killed protesting in front of King George V's horse at Epsom Derby in England. And finally, as one of his final acts in office, Archivist of the United States John Carlin announced design contracts for the National Archives Electronic Records Archives. It's virtually certain, pun intended, that much like punch cards, 8-track discs, and 5.5-inch floppy disks, the state-of-the-art technology we use today, all will soon become obsolete. And this inexorable process of obsolescence will continue to jeopardize our ability to access our archived collections of film, video, and computer records of the past. Carlin hopes to avoid that loss by creating a system that will capture electronic information and preserve it forever. To do this, he has awarded one-year design contracts to Lockheed Martin and Harris Corporation worth about $10 million each. This is Talking History. Last week, in the first part of our 9/11 series, we heard from Joanne Meyerowitz, editor of History and 9/11, and Melanie McAllister, one of the essayists, on why they thought it was important, as historians, to write about the events of 9/11 so soon after the actual event, and on how the press's coverage of that event compared to their reporting on other acts of violence in the past. This week, Fred Nielsen interviews Michael Hunt, who puts 9/11 and our response to that attack into the context of world conflict.
After 9/11, Americans could no longer feel immune from the conflicts of the world. But how do they understand those conflicts? This is the question addressed by Michael Hunt in the essay he contributed to the book History on September 11th, edited by Joanne Meyerowitz. Michael Hunt is the author of numerous works on the history of American foreign relations, including The Making of a Special Relationship and Ideology and U.S. Foreign Policy. He has also written The World Transformed, a college textbook on the history of the world since 1945. Michael Hunt is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Hunt, welcome.
Thanks, Fred, for inviting me.
The Cold War shaped America's view of the world for half a century or more. Now, with the collapse of communism, some scholars argue that we face a new kind of fundamental conflict across the globe, what they call a clash of civilizations, one in which Western values are threatened by the Islamic world in particular. Can we understand 9/11 as a clash of civilizations?
That's certainly been the most popular way it's been framed. I mean, as you suggest, your introductory comments make the interesting point that Cold War did frame our way of seeing the world for a long time. And, of course, the end of the Cold War then created a problem. How would we now reframe the world? And there was a lot of incoherence and uncertainty through the 1990s and the after 9/11. Certainly, we had a kind of a new framework, this clash of civilizations or the war against terrorism as the new way of seeing the world. The problem, of course, is that, as Edward Said pointed out, a widely circulated essay, that no civilization is monolithic or unchanging, and certainly the Middle East, Islamic civilization, Western civilization has, you know, evolved, borrowed from each other. And I mean, in fact, one doesn't even have to be historical here. You can look at some of the polls that have been done in the Middle East, and we think of the area as a kind of hotbed of anti-Americanism. Well, that's true of U.S. policy, but if you ask about things like attitudes toward the U.S. as a land of economic opportunity, a land of technology, a model of democracy. In fact, polls show very high levels of respect, so there's no clash involved. There's, in fact, some admiration and willingness to borrow.
Well, there is, of course, another kind of clash out there. If it's not a clash between civilizations, there are people like Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist and best-selling author, who talk about, I suppose we could call it a clash within civilizations, a clash within the Islamic world between modernizers who want to embrace a global economy and democracy versus traditionalists who oppose these things.
Well, yeah, that's another very attractive kind of bipolar way of looking at this, binary way of looking at the problem. Friedman tends, when he talks about globalization, he tends to sort of confuse globalization with modernization. You know, it's a term that for a long time was in bad odor, but I think people who do global history have been coming back to it again and saying, look, what really makes people modern these days is command of technology that yields greater wealth. Greater wealth in turn has all kinds of social and cultural effects. And it's this kind of incorporation of technology and all that it goes with it is one of the things that makes the Middle East one of the relatively low per capita area of stagnant growth rates and so forth. Globalization, you know, might be a further stimulant to growth and adaptation of technology, but it's not clear that that in itself is the secret. And as the debates over globalization indicate, there are lots of downsides to it, lots of reservations about globalization as well. So Friedman's attempt to kind of frame it, I'm not entirely happy with.
Well, let's take a historical perspective then. A historian would absolutely insist, I suppose, on the need to look at the roots of a present conflict, whatever the nature of that clash happens to be. You make the point in your essay that the U.S. has been deeply engaged in the Middle East since World War II, and you use the word entanglement to describe that involvement. What's been the nature of that relationship?
Well, there, I think conventionally historians who specialize in the history of the region identify three things that came together to produce the U.S. entanglement. One was oil. And that actually, concern with oil actually goes back a little bit before the post-war period, before 1945. I mean, the British discovered to their great amazement that navies depended on oil and made a real push in the region to secure oil supplies through the early part of the 20th century. U.S. began to do the same in the interwar period. But, you know, by 1945, it was really clear that modern industrial economies ran on oil. And so the Mideast as a region where there's a lot of oil began to loom very large. On top of that, then, came the creation of the State of Israel in the late 40s. And the U.S. by the late 60s, 20 years later, had worked out a virtual alliance with Israel. So very close ties between the U.S. and Israel. That further pulled us in. And then the final element to kind of make up this triad of concerns was Cold War fears of the Soviet Union penetrating the region, developing relationships with client states, weakening the U.S. Communications lines, or breaching the containment line, a famous containment doctrine that guided U.S. policy. So these three things led us to make commitments of a variety of sorts around the region, with the result that part of the world that had really not loom very large in American thinking has increasingly loomed large. I mean, you could almost do a, you know, steadily upward curve of U.S. concern from the late 40s up to the present.
There's a kind of paradox, though, despite all the involvement, the American engagement there in the Middle East, I dare say a lot of Americans don't know that much about the area, not in any detail, in any historical terms. What have been the consequences of American involvement there in terms of attitudes toward Americans by people in the region itself?
There's a real imbalance that you've identified, because we know that people in the region have a really keen sense of the U.S. impact on their country, the relationship with Israel, involvement in other countries around the region. And this, of course, varies from place to place. I mean, I don't think it's really avoid this idea of a monolithic Middle Eastern mindset. But it does contrast very sharply. The Middle Eastern view, I mean, I think sometimes is so aware of the U.S. involvement and U.S. power that it tends to exaggerate and attribute developments to the U.S. that in fact can't be credited to us or blamed on us. It's a problem. And, of course, it contrasts very sharply, as you suggest, with popular view in the States that sort of sees 9/11 occurring against a blank slate or, you know, no history there. Maybe the Afghanistan, U.S. involvement in Afghanistan in the 1980s, backing the Mujahideen resistance to the Soviet Union. But beyond that, not seeing the region as having a history that somehow blends in with the events of 9/11 and what's followed. Obviously, there's even a deeper history of French and British colonialism and the Ottoman Empire and a lot of other things that ideally we'd like to include if we had a really historical sense of the point we've stepped into in this stream of history.
Well, it strikes me that in some ways Americans become most aware of an area, the Middle East or other places for that matter, when things go badly wrong. Case in point would be the Iranian Revolution of the late 70s, 78, 79, that saw the overthrow of the Shah of Iran, a U.S. ally, and the establishment of an Islamic State, and of course the taking of the U.S. hostages at the embassy followed shortly after that. That's you suggested right. that Iranian Revolution was, these are your words, a defining watershed moment. What was its significance in your view?
Well, I think probably for the U.S. it was important because it, for the first time, pulled us up short. We had not really encountered serious opposition, reverses in the region, and this was really the first time that we began to sense limits of our power. I mean, and it was a real, for anyone who can remember the days of Carter's humiliation and so forth, this was not a pleasant discovery at all. It you know, virtually destroyed the Carter, or played a very large role in destroying the Carter presidency. For people within the region, yeah, I think it also had, you know, was really an important moment because it was the first time that a kind of bubbling Islamic politics had a success, translated into organization and scored a success. And if you look back, say, at places like Egypt, like Syria, I mean, you can see rising kind of concerns with Islam as a replacement for secular ideologies that had failed, hadn't delivered the goods. But none had really been able to turn themselves into an effective political movement. And so here in Iran, you really do get this in a very dramatic way, taking on, you know, this U.S. client and moving from there to shedding or expelling the groups that are allied with the Islamists, many of them secular, urban, educated. They get pushed to one side and you end up with an Islamic Republic. So this is a really kind of a very heady moment in showing the potential of Islam. And then finally, I mean, the thing that I think is often missed is the sort of consequences broadly for the region once the destabilizing consequences, because once the revolution takes hold, the Soviets freak out. They're worried that Islamic sentiment is going to spread from Iran into Afghanistan, into Soviet Central Asia. And we now know from Soviet archives that that actually played a role in the Soviet decision to send troops into Afghanistan. Saddam Hussein in Iraq sees an opening, attacks Iran, sets off an 8-year war with Iran, 1980-88, I think the largest, most significant war in the post-war period. And then, of course, that war begins to destabilize the region and fuel Saddam Hussein's ambitions, and that leads to the first Gulf War, and the first Gulf War is not a long step. You can begin to see the lines to the second Gulf War from there, kind of uncompleted business in the American view. So it's actually the Iranian Revolution is really important in kind of shaking up the region, not for the good.
Obviously, there's a history here that's worth talking about and knowing, and you make that point very clearly in your essay. You write at one point that understanding the past is useful, perhaps even essential way of providing orientation in the presence of confusing events like those after 9/11. I wonder if I could follow up on that a little bit, though. I guess part of me wonders, how we can keep history from becoming just another source of confusion. I can think of, I suppose we all can think of, examples of how leaders and other people have used the past to take us in directions that in the final analysis weren't really all that good. American leaders charged into Vietnam with examples of World War II in their minds, and it didn't turn out well at all.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there are probably two ways in retrospect that history, you know, could play a role, and in fact has played a role. And I think there have been historians who have, you know, made an effort to step forward and say, okay, Iraq has a history, Afghanistan has a history. I mean, each of these areas has to be seen not simply as a blank slate on which Americans can write. And I think the other way that history can play a role is by critically examining the historical assumptions, whether it's the Munich analogy, the one you referred to, fear of repeating the experience before World War II, democracy's failure to stand up to Hitler, or maybe the domino theory, or whatever it happens to be. These are ideas that can be subjected to historical examination. And in this case, I think what's most clear is the belief that, well, we're facing a new kind of Cold War threat, or we can repeat in Iraq what we did in Japan or Germany. I mean, these are historical propositions, and I think we can go back and look at them and say, okay, well, to what extent are there parallels here, or to what extent are these propositions, you know, well-grounded, at least as far as historians understand the events?
To bring things back to 9/11 and the world after September 11th, if the United States has a foe these days, who or what might it be? Is it Al-Qaeda? Is it fundamentalist Islam? Is it the Islamic world as a whole?
Well, each of the alternatives you offered there are pretty sweeping, and I'd be much more discreet. Obviously, Al-Qaeda is a wide-ranging organization, not simply in the Middle East, but, you know, in the kind of Islamic diaspora, people operating overseas as well. But I think probably fundamentally, you know, we need to see this kind of Islamic politics as not one thing, but something operating under different conditions, different experiences, different outlooks in country to country. I mean, we have Islamic politics in Turkey that are parliamentary. And in fact, Turkey is an ally of the United States, and those Islamic politics have not gotten in the way. Algeria, we have a different case where Islamists began to challenge secular nationalist leaders in the late 80s and early 90s, won an election, or at least won the first round of elections, and then the military, the government's forces, turned on them and drove them underground. So there we've got a different kind of experience. You know, Iraq has not been a place where Islamic politics have been allowed to exist. We've already talked about Iran a little bit, and there, you know, it's extremely interesting and I think closely studied in the Islamic world. You know, what's going on in Iran? People try to come to terms with what an Islamic polity means, a modern Islamic polity. I mean, it's very fluid and very complex. So my feeling would be that we're much better off seeing these, you know, seeing ourselves not confronted by one problem like monolithic global communism. I think probably a misconception of the Cold War. We ought to avoid that same kind of attempt to reduce the problem to one simple dimension.
Near the end of your essay, you write that if the clash unfolding before us involves some sort of fundamentalism, it's tempting to say that it's almost as much ours, that is the United States, as it is theirs. What's America's fundamentalism?
I think wars maybe do this to us. I mean, we become mobilized, we want to crusade, we want to defend our values. We assume that people out there are enemies or friends. I mean, there's kind of simple way of handling the world. And this was the way, I mean, in fact, the Bush administration initially, I think, embraced this very, very strongly. And much of the population did, too, for, I think, reasons that are probably understandable. Here was a moment when we could deal these bad people a blow and transform the Middle East. And, you know, in the last couple of years, I think, as we've actually gone about this little enterprise, it's turned out that it's not so easy and that we're a divided country. And part of that division is over, you know, exactly this point. How much can the U.S. change the world? What kind of role should the U.S. play in the world? And I think this is a kind of an issue that lurks beneath the surface. We're a little undecided now about exactly, you know, what our role is. And certainly our doubts have been reinforced by criticism abroad, particularly from our allies. I think we're all very aware of that. So this is a kind of an interesting moment when our confidence is beginning, as a nation, is beginning to bleed away a little bit. How fruitful a debate we might have out of that, I think, remains to be seen.
Well, Professor Hunt, thanks so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with Michael Hunt. His essay, In the Wake of September 11th, is one of the essays collected in the book History in September 11th, edited by Joanne Meyerowitz.
Marilyn Young, professor of history at New York University, wrote yet another essay in the collection History and 9/11. But rather than inviting her to discuss what she wrote in the essay, we asked her to reflect as a historian on history and the events of September 11. Professor Young is the author of several books on U.S. foreign policy, including The Vietnam Wars, 1945 to 1990. She called in her response while traveling in Vermont.
When I reflect on history in September 11, what strikes me most forcefully about the subject is the absence of history. In its place, we have the self-fulfilling prophecy. Shortly after September 11, the country was instructed on the central role of Iraq in the network of terrorists who would destroy America and all the things for which it stands. 3 years later, the administration has made it come true. The war now has its justification, albeit asked backwards. Similar self-fulfilling prophecies marked the course of the Vietnam War. Early on in the Vietnam War, pundits and policymakers worried that U.S. tactics served to recruit people to the ranks of the National Liberation Front, as indeed they did. Today, pundits and policymakers express similar worries about both Afghanistan, where the Taliban is resurgent, and Iraq, and they too are correct. By 1972, North Vietnamese forces really did cross into the South in a manner that invoked memories of the Korean War. It took the policies of four U.S. administrations to achieve this end. During the Vietnam War, as today, even those pundits and policymakers who opposed the war were anxious about the bloodbath that would surely ensue if the U.S. withdrew completely, ignoring the one daily perpetrated by the presence of U.S. forces. In 1968, the Democratic Party worried that the American public remained wedded to a military victory in Vietnam, though the public itself seemed wedded only to a desire for it to end. In 2004, the Democratic Party seems convinced, in Bill Clinton's words, that the country would, quote, rather have somebody who's strong and wrong than somebody who's weak and right, end quote. And so, perhaps out of conviction, perhaps out of expediency, John Kerry challenges Bush to a contest of strength and promises not an end to the war, but a sharing of its burdens with alienated allies. For its part, when it is not creating the conditions to fulfill the history it claims impels its policies, the Bush administration is actively stifling history altogether. It has decided that history and accountability ended on September 11, 2001. The only legacy of that event is what the administration offered the country on September 12, a perpetual war against selected states deemed by Washington to be a potential threat. The compression of all categories of opposition to U.S. policies anywhere in the world into the single category, terrorist. The exchange of civil liberties for the chimera of absolute security. And, in the name of free enterprise, the increasing concentration of wealth and power in the hands of a favored few.
You've been listening to Marilyn Young, professor of history at New York University. Finally, to conclude this special series marking the third anniversary of 9/11, for our Site of the Week segment, Talking History's Fiona Beatty tells us about an exhibit on the events of September 11th that may be coming to a museum near you.
We all recall where we were and what we were doing when the news hit that hijacked planes had struck the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. Collectively, we bore witness to history. On the first anniversary of the attacks, the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, Bering Center, opened its September the 11th Bearing Witness to History exhibition. Now traveling to various cities in the country, the exhibition invites visitors to reflect upon their personal recollections of that day by asking, how did you witness history on September the 11th, 2001? and has your life changed because of that day? The responses are collected in a permanent archive, and the artifacts, powerful in their poignancy, offer the visitor tactile testimony of the events of 9/11, among them clothing worn by survivors, objects left in memorial sites, and a stairwell sign from the 102nd floor of the World Trade Center. Photographs provide powerful imagery of captured moments of the attacks and their aftermath, and the voices of survivors and rescue workers broaden the canvas of memories. There's a 10-minute video produced by ABC News featuring the personal experience of news anchor Peter Jennings and other reporters who had not only to relay the news but digest it themselves. September the 11th, Bearing Witness to History, is a place to pause and reflect. The tour schedule is posted on the Smithsonian Museum's website. To find out more, check it out at their website, www.si.edu.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you enjoyed the program. As always, we welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OEH, visit our website at oeh.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.